What are you doing?
We are entering your mind.
What?
To prove that you have the unlocked potential to be a master builder. Uja hybrid.
Whoa, are we inside my brain right now? It's big. I must be smart.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not hearing a lot of activity here.
I don't think he's ever had an original thought in his life.
That's not true. For instance, one time I wanted to have a bunch of my friends over to watch TV, not unlike this TV that just showed up magically. And not everybody can fit on my one couch. And I thought to myself, well, what if there was such a thing as a bunk bed, but as a couch? Introducing the double-decker couch. So everyone could watch TV together and be buddies.
That is literally the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Please, Milestein, let me handle this. That idea is just the worst.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm managing editor Matt Goldberg, and with me today is associate editor Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
And contributing writer Hunter Daniels.
Hey, hey.
Today we'll be talking about The Lego Movie, which everyone loved except Adam. And when I say that, apparently we were talking before the show, and he only liked it, so we're going to just burn him at the stake, because that is the majority consensus. It's crazy how many people liked this movie, and I'm happy that they did, but we're going to talk about the film, and I'm glad that Adam has different feelings on it than we did, and we can, rather than just be like, and wasn't this awesome, and wasn't that awesome, and wasn't this awesome, and everything was awesome, and that's why there's a song. And then we can also talk about, we're going to expand it to talk about other toy properties and why they don't translate to film as well. And then we're also going to talk about how creative restrictions help breed creativity, because if you were to just say, if you wanted to be cynical about it from the start, and people were, I don't want to say rightfully cynical, because I don't think cynicism is always justified, but wary of a property based off a toy. It's like, oh, here's a huge conglomerate, and they're making a big commercial, which is not an unreasonable criticism before seeing the film. So we're going to talk about all that, but I've written my Lego review. It was gushing praise. So I'm going to hand it over to you guys. Hunter, since you're a guest on the show, what were your thoughts on the Lego movie?
Well, I mean, I've been a big fan of Christopher Miller and Philip Lord for a long time, starting with, I think the first thing I saw of theirs was a pilot they did for something called Awesome Town with the Lonely Island guys, who ended up doing, like, Lazy Sunday and Dick in a Box and all those SNL digital shorts and obviously their albums. And these guys are geniuses because they have this ability to take, you know, these properties that are part shit, like a 21 Jump Street movie should be a cheap cash-in. A Lego movie, you know, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs doesn't have a narrative as a book. And then they imbue it with like a deep, deep sense of emotion. And they did that again with the Lego movie. Maybe not as much as in Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which is their high watermark, but it's really engaging and funny. And oh my God, visually, this movie is so cool to look at. And I just pretty much loved most everything about it. It wasn't quite as sincere as some of their earlier work, but it just folds in on itself and really, really takes the idea and explores it on a very thorough level.
Okay. And Adam, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I liked it quite a bit. I mean, saying that I didn't fall head over heels for it is just, to me, it was a consequence of listening to everyone saying, you know, calling it a masterpiece for a week until I actually had a chance to see it. I think it was a bit overhyped, which is, hype is a weird thing. I mean, when you see a movie you really like, you want to talk about it and you want to get people excited for it. But when I just kept seeing tweets and tweets saying not just that it's really good, but like it's amazing and the best animated film in years, and you know, I went in with a certain amount of expectations that at a certain point just became impossible to surpass. But I enjoyed it. I thought it was really funny. Like Hunter said, I think Phil Lord and Chris Miller, I think they have a knack for embracing the flaws in the properties that they take on. Like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs is ridiculous, so they embrace that ridiculousness and just go overboard with it. And the Lego Movie is a commercial, and they embrace the fact that it's a commercial, and they find a way to make that interesting instead of kind of running away from it or trying to do something completely different from, you know, what everyone knows it's going to be. I liked all the kind of vocal cameos. I liked just their idea of approaching a Lego movie. I think in someone else's hands, they would have just gone, you know, 3D animation, just a straightforward movie, you know, with things that look like Legos, but these are actual Legos, and they move like Legos, and they talk like Legos, and the sound effects are Legos. When a boat speeds away, it's a person going instead of an actual boat noise. So it kind of, like I said, it embraces the fact that it's a commercial and that kids love to play with Legos, and Legos are a way to kind of let imagination run rampant. And I think Chris Pratt was absolute perfect casting for the lead here. I think it's fantastic, and I'm really happy for him to see that he's kind of getting his due with this and Guardians of the Galaxy and then Jurassic World. So,
and this and his role as Emmett is channeling Andy Dwyer a little bit from Parks and Rec, but I love Andy Dwyer, so seeing this sort of transplant into Lego,
yeah, it's
was
totally fine.
Perfectly
it's,
fine.
It's kind of the same guy.
Yeah.
I mean, it helps that it's when you're not seeing him physically play the same role,
yeah,
then it works just as a vocal performance. I would just.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It was a little bit difficult for him because he's basically playing the straight man. He's playing complete idiot, but he doesn't get the big flashy character moments. But he's still like, he made me laugh very consistently. And there's often a problem where the main character is the least funny character in one of these films, and he manages to really shine even while playing the straight man.
Oh, yeah. Hunter, going back to something you said earlier about how you don't think it had the same level of emotional thrust, I would disagree with that. I mean, I love Cloudy, and I think it does have, like, an emotional center that I really liked. But I think that, and I'm not going to spoil anything, but I think where Lego goes and where it goes so unexpectedly, I think the emotions there are a little more complex without coming off as, like, a homily. So it's not just a matter of be yourself, but it's like find, you know, your creativity, which I think is really encouraging to say to kids, what is your own, how do you express yourself? And I thought that was a really interesting way rather than just be the best you can be, which is kind of vague, you know. I liked that this was more focused, and it also without being exclusionary. It wasn't just say you're bad if you follow the instructions, which I was sort of worried about because I like following the instructions. I think that's fun, but it's saying that you can do that, but also, why not combine sets or move things together or have worlds cross over? Even if it's as something as Superman interacting with William Shakespeare, you can do that. And then, of course, there is another thing that happens, which I think was really, like, you know, really got the, it's like really, I got verklempt, if I could quote that old SNL skit, and I will. It was nice, and I really like that. I think it builds on the emotion of Cloudy. So, and I don't want to get into nitpicks, like, this was a 10 of emotion, whereas Cloudy was only a 9. I just felt that, for me, Lego Movie felt like a step forward, which is what you want to see from filmmakers.
I agree. I mean, like, this movie was shockingly sincere, and even behind all the sort of, like, hey, look, here's this, you know, there's some cameos in this that haven't been in the trailers that when you see it come on stage, you'll gasp. Like, how did they get the rights to that? Sort of like a, almost like a Who Framed Roger Rabbit type feel. But in this movie, at least to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, it felt a lot like it was built on a very similar chassis to Cloudy, where Andy Samberg's character in that, Baby Brent, is very similar to Batman in this film. Sam Sparks, Anna Faris's character, is very similar to the girl in this film, though.
To Wild Style? Oh, I don't see that at all.
Yeah, I don't see those. Really, because I think they're completely different.
I mean,
on the vague level, I mean, on the broad level of, you know, the hero originally feels inadequate compared to Batman and then to Baby Brent, and that there is a love interest. I mean, that they have kind of an awkward relationship with at first, but really, I think that is really, as on those broad levels, I don't really see any other similarities.
Okay, I mean, it's possible that I had just watched Cloudy again a couple of weeks ago because I got a Blu-ray of it, and what it felt to me here was that in that film, there's a moment where they take off Steve's translator and give it to the father, and the father's allowed to express himself properly. And in this film, when the big twist happens, there's also some role play where characters are using a very similar device. And I mean, it's great in both, and they use, like, obvious metaphors, like our main character has a blank face And every other character has, like, he holds a sausage or he has a beard or something. And so to show his not fitting in by being so blank works as a visual metaphor. But I don't know, like, a Cloudy the Chance of Meatballs got me a little teary-eyed, and this one didn't quite, so it's only superb and not perfect.
Yeah, and I think at some point it just comes down to personal preference. But I like what you said about sort of the blank face, and that's, one of the things I like about the movie is that there's a great attention to detail. And Adam, you mentioned that as well, where if a ship speeds away, it's like that little weird little sound. And it's that kind of thing, because I don't think it's, to me, that doesn't even signal the commercialism of it, though, because I think if they had done something commercial, they would have gone more along the lines of the Ninjago TV show.
Well, no,
they have
on Nickelodeon. I was saying it's embracing the fact that this is a movie about Legos and not just like an animated movie where we're using Legos, but we're going to pretend like it's not a big commercial, so we're just not going to address the fact that they're Legos. Like, it's just Legos. But this movie embraces the fact that, like, Legos allow our imagination to run wild. So what is it like when kids play with Legos? And I felt, that's how I felt. Not just like a, I felt like another filmmaker could have just taken it and said, like, you know, the Lego movie, but it basically, like, everything looks like Legos, but it's not going to be about Legos. But this movie is about Legos, and it works.
Right. And we've seen that hypocrisy before. In fact, we see it too often. And the one that springs to mind immediately as we're talking about this is The Lorax, which isn't based off a toy, but is just like, here's something that we can animate, and it has none of the values of the source material. It really is fucking awful. Because that's the thing. And that's a story, and stories have narratives that clearly have subtext and values, and it missed the mark completely. Whereas with Lego, there's no story there. There's nothing. You really have to build it from scratch, which, again, I really liked. And one of the things that I think is clever about it is that even then, as they're building it, it's so knowingly part of, like, the hero's journey kind of story. Yeah. And yet, even then, they kind of tweak and rebuild it in a really clever way.
Yeah, it's very intelligent. And the way that, you know, I know that there was a lot of excitement and then some criticism of Wreck-It Ralph, which was similarly themed, because that film had this really cool bit in the beginning where you see Wreck-It Ralph going through all the other video games, and then that kind of disappears. But here, you're getting, you know, the 1980s spaceship guy with the broken helmet, which was a great touch, shows up partway through, and you just sort of get these cameos after cameos in new and different ways throughout the whole thing, which I thought was wonderful.
Right. And I don't even think the cameos took over. Even Batman. I think Batman became part of their story rather than being like, oh, we're going to rest on our cameos. Like, the cameos were cameos. They were fun. Mm-hmm. So even the biggest one, Batman, who is a main character, doesn't overshadow Emmett.
No.
And in fact, he just becomes sort of a running parody, and to the point where he makes his own song. By the way, if you see this movie, sit through the credits. Stay through the credits for the full Batman song. It is amazing.
Well, and I read an interview recently with Phil and Chris. It was a spoilery interview, and they talked about about those cameos, and they said that they kind of had to make sure that it made sense with the story. I guess there was a lot more with Wonder Woman in another cut of the movie, but they just kind of whittled it down because it just wasn't working with the rest of the story. So they were very mindful of not just, like, you know, and now let's play around with Wonder Woman, because this is the first time that Wonder Woman has ever appeared in a feature film, and, you know, it's very small. They could have easily just kind of, like, you know, we have Wonder Woman, so we're just going to do a lot of Wonder Woman.
Well, a theatrically released feature film, because they do the animated DC ones that go
yeah,
through
that's
the video.
What, that's yeah, that's what I meant, like a theatrically yeah, released feature film.
Just to be clear to the listeners who
but
wanted to be...
With Batman and all, maybe less some of the others who are minor characters, but especially with Batman, they use him the way that when I was a little kid and played with Legos and my other action figures together, like, Batman would show up and he'd maybe still be Batman. Well, you know, a character is less recognizable, I might invent my own character for him.
Right. Well, and see, the other thing is, even looking at all the cameos, there's still IPs that weren't in the film. There's no Marvel characters in it, and there's no... They had Toy Story for a while, but that's probably a Disney thing that they didn't want to bring in there, but they Lego had it, and of course, that's the whole thing, Hunter, you were saying. It's like, how did they even get some of these? Now, Warner Brothers, it's easy, but when you start crossing over to some things that they have and some things that they don't. So Warner Brothers doesn't own Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but Lego currently has that license, even though Paramount, I believe, they have the ownership of Ninja Turtles on the whole. So yeah, there's a lot of crossing licenses, but it works, and again, it doesn't overshadow what's there. So it was interesting, and I think it's a nice touch that further adds to the world, and that it becomes the main thrust of it, rather than being like, oh, here's that thing, and here's that thing, and here's that thing. Because there was, I'm just gonna shut up, because I feel like the more I want to talk about it, the more I'm gonna be on the verge of spoiling things. And one of the things I love about it is that it's so surprising in so many ways.
Oh yeah, the audience gasped and applauded when people showed up on screen several times.
Yeah, that happened in my screening too. Adam, how did it go on yours? Because I wanted to see it again this weekend, couldn't get in, just sold out shows.
Yeah, no, there was a lot of sold out shows. Mine was mostly a lot of kids, the screening I went to, and I mean, I don't know, I was seated towards the front, so I couldn't really hear the audience. The audio was loud on the movie, which was a good thing, so I couldn't really hear. But everyone seemed to respond to it. As I was walking in, a little kid was walking out singing "Everything Is Awesome," which is the most infectious earworm that I feel like I'm going to be hating in the next couple of days, because I can't get it out of my head.
Oh, I've had that. Exactly. I would also say in Atlanta, there's a theater called Phipps Plaza, and it is located directly next to a Legoland, to an in-mall Legoland store. That business must be booming after that movie, to be able to go right out the door and then go buy Lego toys about 50 feet away.
Did you guys see this at industry screenings, press screenings, or did you see this with audiences?
I saw it at a promo screening, so it was a theater with a general audience that was invited to see it early. So it was a mix of adults and kids and press.
Yeah, I saw it with an audience.
Yeah, I saw it at Friday night at The Grove, which is sort of a high-end theater in Los Angeles. And so it's like the kind of place where they have assigned seating in a bar in the lobby. So it was mostly adults seeing it, and I was really surprised by how very, very packed it was with adults of all ages, and how you could hear the kids who were there as well as the adults. Everyone was laughing and at different things. It really plays to different demographics very well.
Oh, this is the first four quadrant movie in ages. It played like it hit every single quadrant that it was. That, you know, this is what studios dream of, having a movie that's hit with, you know, kids, men, women, and adults. So, and it hit all four of those perfectly. There was no, like, it didn't skew heavily towards kids, it didn't skew heavily towards boys, you know, it hit everywhere.
Well, circling back to something we were talking before the show, is that we were saying about how you have something like Lego, which is ostensibly for kids, although I have them, I enjoy building them, it's very relaxing, but you have other properties that are made for kids, like board game adaptations, and in a way they try to appeal directly to adults, like Battleship, and they end up appealing to nobody. And I'm sort of wondering how...
Well, first off, we should say that the planned board game adaptations, Hasbro sold, like, set up movie adaptations of, like, all of their board games, and it was going to be this
God.
Big run of board games and Candyland and Monopoly, and Battleship is the only one we've gotten. So I guess Ouija is kind of...
Well, all those deals fell apart. I mean, really, just Universal signed a horrible deal with Hasbro because they saw how well... I mean, Hasbro has Transformers, which is, you know, still a different... You know, it's a toy, which is a completely different game, but Universal was looking at, like, oh my God, you know, look at all these franchises that other studios have. We got to get in on that. So they made this horrible deal with Hasbro about, we'll make all your board games into movies, and if we don't, we'll be penalized for it. And eventually they're like, we'll take the fucking penalty, because if we make fucking Clue and Monopoly and Ouija's still happening.
Yeah,
but it's not...
But it's like a Blumhouse, like, low budget production. Yeah. I don't think Blumhouse is doing it, but it's like a micro budget horror movie now.
Michael Bay's company. I think it's Platinum Dunes.
Yeah, Platinum Dunes.
I actually think that, like, the Clue movie that exists is great.
Yeah,
and
it's fantastic.
I think you could make a really kick-ass movie out of Candyland if you went sort of on a darker, early Tim Burton, Terry Gilliam type vibe on that. I can see a great movie out of that.
Well, see, and that's the thing. I can see great movies in these sort of board games as well. Like, I think Battleship, it's like, I want to make Transformers. Like, no, don't make Transformers. What you have here is a great naval warfare movie. When was the last time you saw that? And
K-19?
That could have been really cool. Exactly. Oh, God. Yeah, K-19 has its moments. I would have to go all the way back to Crimson Tide.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not even really about the warfare. That's the drama on the boat. But again, like, I think that's a cool action film that no one else is doing, and Peter Berg and Universal is like, let's just make Transformers.
Well,
let's just have
kind
like,
of though. I mean, I liked Battleship more than others. The Transformer stuff was boring, but he got into like some like veteran stuff that was really cool towards the end.
It was
a mixed bag, and I think that, you know, Universal, well, first of all, the deal was, he said, hey, Universal, I want to make Lone Survivor. They said, okay, make Battleship for us first. And he was like, well, okay, because I want to make Lone Survivor. So he made Battleship, kind of begrudgingly. But
and you can really feel the begrudging.
I did a visit to the editing bay of that film, and Peter Berg came out. He had sort of a mountain man beard. And he actually seemed excited about it. And the way that they described it then, there were some ideas, as well as like this weird, like almost Coen Brothers-y sense of humor to the first act that didn't exist as much in the final version. But I mean, Peter Berg is talented. They were going to make a new movie based on Clue that was going to have Gore Verbinski, who's as good a visual storyteller as anybody else in this generation. Like, but then you have issues with, like, they've tried for 20 years and spent $15 to $20 million on different scripts to Stretch Armstrong. Like, every comedy writer in Hollywood tried to make Stretch Armstrong, and they could not figure it out, because at the end they realized, oh, it's just something that's fun to look at and play with. There is no narrative here.
I can come up with a narrative. Here's a narrative for a Stretch Armstrong short film. It's that some kid has stabbed him, and he's leaking corn syrup, and if he doesn't find more, he'll die.
Crank.
Boom. Nailed it. Exactly. Crank with Stretch Armstrong.
That's a great short film. And you might actually have a Stretch Armstrong gag like that in this Lego movie, but it would still feel warm and nice.
Yeah. Oh, going back to Lego Movie, one of the things I like about it is that there are non-Legos in it. There's non-Lego items, and they use them so well. Like the Cloak of Bandaid.
Oh my gosh. It's just the way that they build a world. The world building in this is actually really, really good, and on a level that you would normally associate with larger fantasy properties.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. There's a breadth of creativity, whereas, again, and it feels like in Battleship, and I don't want to rag on that one, because there's so many other movies we can rag on that have failed these toy tests, but Battleship, it, like, had to work to be, like, work in the references. Like, okay, the weapons, you know, the little weapons will be pegs, and then we'll do our little D12 thing, and at some point, someone has to say, you sunk my battleship. Like, they really have to work for it.
Motherfucker.
God.
I think the way forward for Hasbro and these properties is that they should do something similar to this Lego movie. And I'm sure that they've already thought of this and are working on it, but, you know, Night at the Museum in a Hasbro factory is where they're going to go with this eventually, where they will find ways to plug in all the different products and properties as cameos in ways that people will be excited to see 30 seconds of Super Mario Brother, while they won't necessarily want to watch a whole Super Mario Brother movie.
Oh, Nintendo will never give that shit up.
It's not happening.
Oh, Nintendo will never give up. I mean, that's why there's so many fan films for their properties. Nintendo got burned so badly on Super Mario Brothers.
The very first video game movie ever.
And I disagree, because that movie is unbelievably awful, but it's not the kind of awful that hacks make. The people making it had huge ambitions, were doing the weirdest. Like, honestly, that might be the best version of a Super Mario Brothers movie that could exist, because that's not going to be a good movie no matter what.
I disagree with that. I think a Super Mario Brothers movie could be good because it's weird, and I think that the movie they made was very compromised in how it was forced to be made, but I think Super Mario is kind of like a weird, fun concept to begin with. Like, I'm going to take mushrooms and get bigger, and I'm going to grab a star and, like, you know, become invincible. Like, when you say that shit out loud, it actually sounds really fun and weird, but that's the whole thing. It's how closely do you want to hew to material that doesn't really have a story? And at some point, you probably just reach Charlie Kaufman level and you make a movie about not being able to make your movie. So I don't know. I think that when you have these restrictions, you can do some interesting things, or you just sort of embrace the craziness of it. Or you can do what these Nintendo sort of fan films do, because you see other things like, yes, Metroid has a narrative, Zelda has a narrative. That's not too difficult, but they'll never give that up in a million billion years unless they are the studio making it, which is kind of where things might be headed now that Ubisoft is like, we are going to have a lot of control over our movies, because Prince of Persia sucked, and we're not going to have that happen again. So we're going to be very closely tied with Assassin's Creed and Splinter Cell. Yeah. We're not going to be cut out of the process anymore.
How's that working out for Neil Blomkamp's Halo movie again?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, but that was the whole thing. That became too controlling. And there were way too many cooks in the kitchen, because you had Microsoft, and you had Bungie, and you had the studio, and you had a director that no one had, who couldn't really wrangle it.
Yeah, and he had ideas that Bungie wasn't comfortable with, and he was like, well, all right.
Exactly.
I'm going to part ways now, because Bungie was like, no, it has to be this, because it is this.
And I would just say to Bungie, you know what, Bungie? It's kind of a dumb story. People don't play Halo for the story.
No.
You should just step aside on that one. But I would say, though, I don't necessarily mind Ubisoft being involved should the film... we don't know how those films will turn out. I don't think it's wrong for them to try to want to manage their IP if they can do it well. And those video games do have story. And I like to credit Lego for not really butting in on this one that much. I mean, they could have been really controlling when you stop to think about it with how valuable that brand is. And it looks like when I'm watching this film, I see a vision of directors rather than a corporation that clearly will profit from it greatly, but rather than be like, no, you need to force this thing and this thing and this thing.
I think it helps that there's no mythology around Legos. They're just toys. So I think it helps that Lego wasn't able to say, Lego lore,
Well, they could have, though. They could have been like, you really need to put in more Ninjago stuff, which has its own mythology. Yeah. It's like, you need to... the characters on the team should be Ninjago.
They're doing a Ninjago movie.
And they're...
Right, but that's its own thing, rather than forcing it into the Lego.
But that's where the sequels to this one go, because this movie
into Ninjago. No,
this movie's very, very standalone, and the way that it ends doesn't necessarily lend itself to an easy sequel. But they'd go the way that they did with the later Muppet movies, where you had Muppets in Space or Muppet Treasure Island. You'll have a movie set probably with a character, or maybe even like a human child who gets sent into the Lego world or something weird like that, and it will tell a story that will be something that's probably a public domain copyright that we all know, and will tie in with a bunch of the Lego toys. So first you build the large macro world, and then they can play within it in smaller ways to push specific brands in the future, I bet.
I mean, that's one way to go. I mean, to me, honestly, I don't know what to expect other than it looks like right now it won't be the same team. It looks like Lord and Mill, it will sort of be whatever the Lego Movie sequel is, it'll be done in the same way that Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2 was, where
they said they're going
to
produce it. Their plan right now is to
produce it. They're going to have a little oversight into it, but it's not going to be them directing it again, which is kind of a shame, but I liked Cloudy 2. It's not as good as the first one, but it's enjoyable.
They were clearly very involved in Cloudy 2, because Chester and his ape are designed to look a lot like Scudworth, the principal in that movie, and like move even the sort of weird squid movements. And one of the writers, I think the first writer on that film, was one of the staff writers on Clone High. So even if they're not directing the next one, they could be sort of Christopher Nolan on the Superman movie, Justice League movie level, guiding the franchise, I guess.
Well, Christopher Nolan's not going to be involved.
He doesn't give a fuck about it.
He's so fucking done with all of it. Yeah, thank God for that.
I'd rather see original Chris Nolan movies anyway. So.
Well, what Warner Brothers is doing now, they launched an animated film division, like Coalition. They have a team of writers. One of them is Nicholas Stoller, Phil Lord and Chris Miller are part of it too, and they're developing animated films in-house, but they're all... basically, Warner Brothers is creating their own Pixar brain trust, where these writers work on separate projects, but they get together and kind of... give notes and stuff on each other's projects. And so I think that's where the Lego Movie sequel will come. I mean, they've already got one of the writers, Jared Sterns, working on the Lego Movie sequel now, and so they'll have input on that. And so I think they'll be around, but they don't want to spend another 4 years. I mean, to direct a movie like this, they in the time that it took them to make the Lego Movie, they made 21 Jump Street and 22 Jump Street, so they don't have time to kind of devote that much to another
film. Right. Well, and the other thing is when you have a hit, when you have three hits in a row, and this is your biggest one, you get fuck you money. Like, you get that kind of clout. Where Lord and Miller's like, we're going to do something. And that makes me really excited to wonder if if they are going to do another adaptation, like if maybe they like this kind of thing where they take a crummy idea and really build off it, or if they have something original, like a completely original story in their back pocket. And when I say completely original, I just mean not based off anything.
They have a movie called The Reunion that they said they're,
oh, yeah,
they
have
the
reunion.
They're going to take a break and then they hope to do The Reunion, which I think Chris is going to direct by himself. But they wrote that together. And that one, we don't know, like, plot details are under wraps, but I guess it takes place at a high school reunion.
Yeah. So, but, I mean, that's good. I mean, again, it's so, these guys are so exciting to watch, and I'm glad that these movies have been a success, because I like where they go and what they do. So I'm happy about that, and I kind of wish, and I kind of hope, and I don't think it's going to happen, because talent is hard to copy, is that other filmmakers will, or other studios will sort of be like, well, maybe we should try to have these own spins on it. But it's so hard to replicate quality, which is why you see all these superhero movies happening where it's just more. It's like, oh, that's why The Avengers was a success. It just had more heroes in it. It's like, not quite. Not quite
we'll
the
make
reason.
A gritty Green Lantern and people will love it.
Oh, shit.
I hate this whole movement where everything's got to be gritty. I really, really, really despise the Green Lantern movie, but I appreciate it. At least it had a sense of fun and levity to it versus being, you know, all very, very dark-faced, when it doesn't need to be for most heroes, superhero characters.
Well, we'll see. I don't think that trend is changing in the Superman universe anytime soon, but... And thank God the Marvel movies are still doing their thing with diversity, no less. So, but we're gonna pull back on this superhero tangent because it's so easy to fall into that, and just steer back to toys. So I'm gonna put it to you. Do you think that there are any toy properties that you think have the potential to succeed or turn around or just trapped? What do you see in this landscape that might be interesting?
Well, I mean, like. It's not exactly a toy. It's another book with no plot that I read as a kid. But I really think you could have a fun sort of The Wrong Man type adventure movie based on Where's Waldo. I think that could actually be like Jason Bourne with Where's Waldo. I don't know why. But
that sounds fun. That actually does sound fun. The every frame would be so crowded.
Yeah.
And you just...
and,
that would be.
And I think that the idea of a Night at the Museum style movie, I didn't like those films, but set in the world of like a Hasbro factory or a toy factory could be exciting. As well as, I mean, I like the Muppet Treasure Island. Those aren't as good as the originals, but they're interesting. You could do things like that, as well as Clue was great once, and I would totally see a movie based on Clue directed by Gore Verbinski, because he has a great dark sense of humor. And I've liked pretty much every movie I've ever seen of his, though I didn't see Lone Ranger yet.
And you know what? You can keep your streak alive by
just
skipping Lone Ranger.
I wanted to see the Silver Bullet Werewolf version. That sounded like an interesting version of what to do with that. He
it's
already had Silver Bullet.
It's still kind of in
there. It's still kind of in there. There's still a werewolf aspect. It's just half developed.
It makes no
so.
Sense.
It makes no fucking sense. Yeah.
Oh,
gosh.
There's also stuff I like about that movie, and then there's a bunch of just kind of... FU stuff in it that's just like, really?
I'm always hopeful
yeah.
and want to like, I want to find something to like in movies, so, you know, but.
Yeah, I mean, that's always the way to go, but honestly, there's a reason we're not talking about Vampire Academy.
But wait. That was written by Daniel Waters. Heathers, Demolition Man, he's written a bunch of cool stuff. I didn't know until this morning who wrote it, and now I'll probably catch it on Redbox.
I mean,. There, to me, I have a morbid curiosity about it, and on the one hand, I like, yeah, Mark Waters directed Mean Girls, but he also directed Mr. Popper's Penguins.
True, but so. Again, Daniel Waters, Batman Returns, is the I don't mean to get on superheroes again, but best comic book movie they'll ever make, based on a superhero, I think.
Penguins with jetpacks, kids.
So cool!
Okay, so, Adam, do you have any ideas for, you know, toys you think might be good, or things you'd like to see on that front?
I mean,
anything
again,
a thin story that you might think could make
again,
a good.
Again, it all depends on the filmmakers. I mean, there's always a bad movie to make out of a good idea and a good movie to make out of a bad idea, as we've seen with Phil Lord and Chris Miller. So, I have no clue. I mean, there could be a good Ninjago movie, there could be a bad Ninjago movie. It really just depends on who you get to come on board, and I mean, Phil Lord and Chris Miller have made a career out of turning bad ideas into good movies. So,
Right. It is. They're rare filmmakers. I'll give them that.
What they can do, though, is if you look at this movie, a lot of the movie appears to be about the way that we develop an interaction, like with Legos. At the beginning of it, they're just, you know, following the instructions mindlessly. And then, you know, he sees this Western world and says this whole new way to play with it. And then, you know, once you've unlocked that creativity, they go to the cloud world where everything's crazy and nothing is mixed together. So they have to learn how to follow the instructions with an eye towards creating themselves. And then in the third act, you see how they're able to have their own ideas and make their own things as an expression of self because they understand the basics now. It's actually like about the creative development process where you have to learn the rules and follow the rules before you can do your own thing. Did you guys see that at all?
All right, and I think... Yes. Okay. I mean, that's the thing. I think restrictions are so important, can be so helpful to creativity, provided they're the right restrictions. There are restrictions like Twilight restrictions where it's like you have to do exactly what the book is doing, and it's just you get something really pointless. Or I would even expand, you know, not just to, you know, kick that soft target. I think that's the problem with Sin City. I think Sin City isn't an adaptation. I think it's a translation. It just moves. It's just a motion comic with famous actors. That's really all it is. So that kind of thing where you're actually using it as a crutch, I think, is a serious problem. Whereas if you go to like the production code era where someone flat out tells you you cannot show this thing, you cannot do this thing, then it breeds creativity. And I think Lego Movie, they had the option. I think that's one of the interesting things about it, is that they kind of had the options, although I was really surprised this movie cost $60 million. I really thought it would have cost a lot more. Now, that's not including the, you know, marketing and all that stuff, but still.
Yeah, that's $60 million cheap for a mostly CG created movie.
For an animated film?
You can, since they built them all based on real Lego blocks, you can just scan the actual physical Lego blocks into the computer, so you save a lot on development costs of designing.
But you still had to build the rig for it to see how they would all interact with each other and click together. I mean, yeah, the dimensions of them are fixed, but even again, I mean, that's one of the things, is they built all of it. They literally had all the pieces, and then they had to, you know, the amount of hours to come up with that visual style and move it all together. I mean, there's one fun scene where they're on the water and the water has to be little Lego like studs.
That was so cool to look at. I need to see this movie again. I might actually go back and see it in 3D because I liked all the falling.
No, you don't need to see it in 3D. No. You can skip the 3D. I don't think they made particularly good use out of it. It's just 3D because animated films need to be 3D now.
Incredibly cheap to convert.
Incredibly cheap to convert, but at least they're not awful conversions.
Sure.
They're not obtrusive as opposed to last-minute 3D conversions. God, Need for Speed. We'll see. I would like to talk to the director about that and clear up some confusion. That's all I'm saying. But, I think when you are working with less, you can sometimes do more. Or other times you just get less.
Even to bring it back to Lone Ranger, I think that if you tell Gore Verbinski and Jerry Bruckheimer, like, no, the budget is a solid, like, 120, 130, which, I mean, obviously you probably have to be more than that because you have Johnny Depp getting his full quote. But, you know, when the Disney budget, when they're like, all right, we're drawing the line at 220, like, that's an insane number, 220 million, like, really, do you need all that money? And then it, you know, it breeds excess. And
right, well, I mean, we talked about that when we were talking about The Hobbit, where it's like Peter Jackson's filmography,
that's what,
you know,
he does now,
quality of his films drops off, is that no one tells him no and saying you don't need a CGI orc, you have these perfectly good looking real one. Looks great. Just put him in the movie. Why are you spending more money to get less from what you're paying?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at filmmakers and you see when they have like a big strong streak, and then you have the fuck you power to make your dream project, very often that is not the director's absolute best work. I can't think of a time when a director has been like, I worked on this for 20 years, it's my dream project, I finally have the power to do it. And then usually it's something a little bit better, but akin to Sucker Punch or something like that.
Well, Sucker Punch was, to be fair, a film that was, I don't want to say taken away from him, but they made him cut certain stuff out of it. I still think it's a film that would have tried to have it both ways, which is that it's a film that is overly indulgent and then wants to criticize its audience for indulging it. You know, it's like, haha, you liked all this thing I clearly put a lot of effort into. It's like, what the fuck? How is this our fault?
Michael Haneke syndrome.
You don't like what we're going to get into dissing on Michael Haneke?
I love Michael Haneke. I think Funny Games is a movie that doesn't understand anything about why people like violent movies and has nothing to say about why people like violent movies.
And then he's going to make it twice.
Yeah, I actually respected more that he made it shot for shot the same soundtrack and typeface the second time. But Naomi Watts' physique was more sexy when she's crawling across the floor, which confused the point a little bit. But anyway.
Well, we're bringing it all in. Now, this is, if you tuned into this podcast today, I bet you weren't expecting to hear us talk about the Lego Movie and Michael Haneke. So that's what he brings. That's what he brings. He brings in some talk about Funny Games. I'm glad this movie turned out so well. Adam, I can totally sympathize when this gets so built up that it just creates unrealistic expectations.
Sure, and I didn't dislike I really liked it, but it was hard to, like...
Sure,
it becomes impossible
for me,
because I'm sitting there waiting, like, all right, when does the absolutely incredible masterpiece thing happen? And it's not going to happen.
I don't know exactly
so.
When that happens. There's a moment.
No, it's not.
Pretty clear.
That's not the...
No. I mean, for you, it didn't happen. I mean, to me, it wasn't like there was a masterpiece moment. Like, for me, 21 Jump Street has a masterpiece moment, and that's when Robert Redford tries to pick up his penis with his mouth. That is the masterpiece moment. That is the crowning achievement of that movie. No, I think Lego is just consistently great throughout, but I read Steve's tweet on it, and I read Jermaine's tweet on it, and that was it, and I ducked everything else. But this was a film I was excited for, not only from the moment that, like, Lord and Miller came on, but when they announced that there would be a character named President Business and Bad Cop. like those kind of names, just those alone, are so much fun. And, like, that kind of stuff signals to you, it's like, oh, they're going to be doing something special here. So, yeah, that's the thing. I don't expect, like, yes, consensus, because sometimes, you know, it's good to disagree and we get good conversation out of that. But I'm happy that a movie came out that I was looking forward to that everybody likes, that it makes everybody happy. Yeah. Wow. is that so much to ask? I think that's good. And I'm glad it was a bigger hit than people expected, and people were already expecting it to be a big hit. So there you go. And we'll see how much, I think it's going to have probably pretty good legs.
Oh, yeah.
I don't really see any.
He did 70 million-ish, and did like 17 million Friday. So like the internal multiplier on that's pretty high. It'll do like 200 million at least, unless there's another really big kids movie coming, which I don't think there is.
There's Peabody and Sherman in a month.
Yeah,
but
no.
That looks terrible.
Oh God! And
talk about a thin idea stretched too far.
When I announced that, I think Robert Downey Jr. was supposed to be playing Peabody or something like that, and it's like that sounded like there could be a cool time travel Bill and Ted type movie there, but there isn't.
All the kids go crazy for Winter's Tale next weekend, so you know.
Or RoboCop, it's aimed right at him.
Oh yeah, now we have a PG-13 RoboCop coming. I forgot about that. Yeah. Oh gosh. Okay, so before we start talking about movies that are in the near future, let's talk about films that were in the past with our recommendations. Hunter, what do you got
well,
for us?
Well, I considered a couple of movies. I thought that another film with a really cool art style was Teacher's Pet, the Gary Baseman animated movie, but more than on a emotional, structural level like this, where it's a smart satire, is Josie and the Pussycats. And I know that seems like a bad idea, but Rachel Lee Cook, Tara Reid in her best, only really good role, Rosario Dawson, Alan Cummings, and Parker Posey all together in a movie that's like Fight Club for teeny boppers with really, really cool, fun music, produced by Dr. Luke. And it's an amazing, fun satire I've probably seen 15 to 20 times. Incredibly quotable. Your girlfriend will love it. Your boyfriend will love it. And you'll be singing the songs for weeks.
What's the plot of it?
The plot is that it came out just after Napster, but it was made just before Napster, and the idea was that it was about a record executive who needs a new prefab pop group. So he finds these three girls, Josie and the Pussycats, walking on the street, and decides to make them into pop stars. But all the music has subliminal messages telling you what to buy and telling you how to conform hidden in it. And then over the course of the story, they discover it. It was also shot by Matthew Labatique, who shot Requiem for a Dream, The Fountain, and Iron Man. And he shoots this teeny bopper comedy like it's a fucking crazy cyber action thriller. And I cannot recommend it highly enough for both the surface, which is fun, and some actual interesting satire hidden underneath.
All right, Josie and the Pussycats. Adam, what do you got for us?
I am recommending the kind of first big work from Phil Lord and Chris Miller, a very short-lived TV show called Clone High. It aired on MTV for one season, and it's an animated series, and it takes place in a high school that's being run as a part of a military experiment, and it's all these clones of famous people. So the main characters are the clones of Abraham Lincoln, Joan of Arc, Mahatma Gandhi. There's, you know, a clone of Cleopatra, and so they're all kind of like high school teenagers. Like Lincoln is the awkward, lanky one, obviously. And I mean, it's got all of Lord and Miller's signature, just goofball, offbeat humor. If you like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs or 21 Jump Street or the Lego Movie, you will also enjoy this. They created it alongside Bill Lawrence, who created Scrubs. And I read an interview recently where I think it was Lord and Miller were talking about how every time they see Bill Lawrence, they talk about trying to get Clone High back together and do more of it. So it only lasted one season, but it was a really great show. It's hard to find. I wish it was on Netflix. It has a DVD. I think it was a co-production between Canada and America, so I think that kind of led to some rights issues stuff. But if you can find it, it's...
I have the DVD, so you can get it on DVD.
Yeah, but I think it's not out of print, but you know, sometimes it's not completely in stock.
It was made by...
Yeah, it's hard to track down.
It was made by Teletoon, which is a Canadian company, and then MTV bought the rights to the U.S. But halfway through the first season in the U.S., there was a magazine article that got published in India, and on Mahatma Gandhi's birthday, there was a 150-person hunger strike to protest the depiction of Mahatma Gandhi as a fun-loving, beer-guzzling teen. So the show was canceled because of a hunger strike in India about... That's actually true. That's not even... There was major anger, and so MTV kind of distanced themselves, and I don't think that MTV released a proper DVD, so you have to get it imported from Canada, which you can do on Amazon.
I don't think my DVD is an import. It doesn't have, like, the Canada rating stickers. It doesn't matter. Either way, you can import Canada DVDs. They'll play in your player. In any case, it is definitely worth checking out Wesley... which is one of the great jokes, running jokes in the series, with Mr. Butlertron.
Yeah, and the voice cast, I mean, it's got Will Forte...
as Abraham Lincoln, and they kind of threw in a
little... Nicole Sullivan, Michael McDonald, a lot of cameos, people like Zach Braff and Sarah Chalk, the Scrubs people, so...
Marilyn Manson does a song about the food pyramid.
Yes. And the place that they all hang out is called the Grassy Knoll, so you know it's got a bunch of like historical in jokes and stuff. So it's a lot of fun, and so if you can find it, I highly suggest checking it out.
Cool. My recommendation this week is sort of a book / movie with Indian in the Cupboard, which started out as a book, and the movie is a fairly close adaptation. The plot of it is this kid he gets sort of a magic key. Passed down to him, and he also receives a little plastic Indian figure. And so he puts the Indian in the cupboard and locks it up, and then he unlocks it, and the Indian is now alive. He's still the same miniature size, but he is alive. And so they start putting other figures in the cupboard, and they come to life as well. So one is an Indian, and they put a cowboy in there next, and so you have these figures in the movie. They sort of, it's more about them finding a bond, whereas in the book it's more of, I don't want to say a mystery, but
the movie's real boring.
It's more
the
movie's real boring.
Call a spade a spade.
Yeah,
that movie
we'll call a spade a spade.
Put me to sleep when
I will say that the book and the movie put you to sleep.
The movie, I never read the book.
I liked the book a lot, and the book is a series. I would say the movie is, for when I saw it, which was a kid, not bad. But I will, Adam, I assume you saw it recently?
No, when I was a kid, I saw it.
Even when you were a kid, you disliked it. Okay. I didn't dislike it as much as you. I don't remember disliking it, but I think the books are better. I know it's weird to recommend books, but I would say that if for if you have a kid, you have a young kid about 10 or so, and even if you're an adult, they're like whatever. They're not terrible books, but I like them a lot, and I think they don't feel kiddie, but they're kind of that like fun imagination. Little, you know, that kind of, it's in the right age group. And I mention it because, again, it's sort of bringing toys to life. And I like the book. And the movie, to me, as I remember it, is not terrible. I didn't dislike it as much as Adam. So there's that. But it's more of there's a book, and then there's a movie if you want to see it afterwards. It was directed by Frank Oz.
Yeah,
exactly. So, if Yoda directed your movie, how can it be bad?
Unless it was In and Out, which is incredible.
And he also directed the score, which made his life a living hell by working with Marlon Brando.
He shot the horrors.
Yeah. Okay, so we just recommended a bunch of other movies that aren't Indian. Bowfinger. Bowfinger's great. Are you kidding me?
For the next podcast, let's talk about Frank Oz movies because they're so good. Bowfinger's fantastic.
Bowfinger is like the last legitimately great Eddie Murphy film. Like, unquestionably, like his best comic performance. And that came out in like 1998.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I can't think of anything after where he was the lead.
Yep, he was. It was co-lead with Steve Martin.
Dreamgirls.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, it's fine. No, that's it. Next show, Frank Oz. All Frank Oz. Okay, thanks for listening, everyone. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Hunter?
I'm on Twitter at My Life's a Cartoon.
Awesome. Well, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.